The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the recordings of the 2016 ACOI Internal Medicine Board Review course. The course was held March 30th through April 3rd, 2016 at the Renaissance Resort at SeaWorld in Orlando, Florida. It features nationally known speakers covering topics of interest to the physician preparing for initial certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Gout and pseudogout, crystal arthropathies is presented by Dr. Howard Feinberg.
Morning. So my first topic for all of you is going to be gout and pseudogout. And I know everybody sitting out there is saying, gout, I know gout, no problem. I will tell you that if you don't listen to what I say, you're going to get the questions wrong. I just recertified, and I tried to pepper my presentations with as many of the questions as I could remember, and spoke with one of my colleagues from the year before and put in all of the questions they could remember. And I'm going to try and cover it all for you. I will tell you, gout has changed. The last couple of years, the diagnosis of gout has changed, what we're recommending for treatment of gout has changed, and some of those questions are going to be on your boards. I don't have any conflicts to disclose. We're going to start with some just basics about gout. First, gout is not hyperuricemia, and hyperuricemia is not gout. You can't diagnose this by doing a blood test and seeing an elevated uric acid level. Gout typically is going to follow years of asymptomatic hyperuricemia, and there is no indication to treat asymptomatic hyperuricemia in a normal renal function patient. Serum urate is increased by a lot of things, by alcohol, by height, by body weight, age, diabetes, a lot of different diseases. Some of those will eventually lead to gout, not all of them. The incidence in men, between 13 and 14 out of every 1,000, in women, 6.4 per 1,000. And that's because estrogen causes increased uric acid secretion or excretion and is somewhat protective. But you can see gout in every age group. Classically, gout will start in men sometime after puberty and start in women sometime after menopause. You can have premenopausal women with gout. That was on the exam. And you can have younger children with gout as well. Okay, it's associated with a lot of diseases, some of them very common, diseases that all of you are familiar with. Diabetes, elevated triglycerides, hypertension, all of the endocrine diseases can be associated with gout. Hypothyroidism is the most classic. We also see it in obesity, alcohol use, one of the major causes of gout. We see it in metabolic syndrome, in pregnancy, any type of acute illness and dehydration. So you're going to see it in the patients in the intensive care unit. You're going to see it in the congestive heart failure patients who have been placed on diuretics. And anything that causes increased cell turnover, such as psoriasis, malignancies. There are also some negative associations. One is rheumatoid arthritis. It's very rare to see gout in rheumatoid arthritis patient. There are case reports of individuals who have it. I've run across that situation, but very rare. It's also less common in systemic lupus and in the spondyloarthropathies, especially ankylosing spondylitis from that group, although it still does occur. There's about a 40% decrease in the incidence in patients with systemic lupus and with ankylosing spondylitis. All right, so here's some of the new stuff. This came out in 2015. It was publicized the year before that. So I don't know if this is going to be on the boards right away or not. This is the new diagnostic criteria for gout. It's a three-step process. Step one, you have to have entry criteria. Entry criteria means you have at least one episode of acute joint swelling. And that's acute joint swelling, not low back pain. These are patients who come in with red, hot, painful, very painful joints that happened overnight, that happened in one day. The longer the period, the lead up to developing the pain, the less likely it's going to be gout. And then entry criteria number two would be they have documented crystals in a joint or bursa. If you have criteria number two, when you get to step number two, sufficient criteria, you're done. Entry criteria number two, crystals in a joint, gives you enough points to qualify for gout. If you don't have that, you have to go to step number three. And this stuff is all relatively new. Previously, to diagnose gout, you had to have crystals in a joint. If you didn't have crystals, you had probable gout if they looked a lot like gout. And if you weren't quite sure, then they had possible gout. Now we can diagnose gout based on diagnostic criteria. In order to do this, you've got to get 8 points. I think I have that down in here for you. Nope, I guess not. 8 points. So the first is location. If it's in their ankle, you get 1 point. If it's in the MTP joint, you get 2 points. The next are the characteristics, and these are the classic picture of gout. Erythema, can't bear touching, great difficulty walking. So this is the person who comes into your office on crutches with their new $100 or $200 pair of sneakers with the end of it cut off and no sock on, so nothing's touching their toe, holding their foot out in front of them and not allowing anyone to get within 6 feet of them in case the air currents would bother their foot. That's how gout presents. Okay, this isn't a subtle problem. Patients who have acute gout don't come in saying, I've been hurting for a while, my foot hurts. So erythema, can't bear touching, great difficulty walking, you can get 1 point for each of those. And then if you've got synovial fluid and it's negative, you must remove 2 points. That's in deference to labs where sometimes the crystal searches aren't perfectly accurate. You may get false results from them. So if your crystal search is negative, you take 2 points off. If it's positive, again, you have the diagnosis. And then we have imaging. You can get 4 points for evidence of urate or for typical joint damage, evidence of urate on DECT scans or an ultrasound where you see a double lumen sign or a classic sign for gout. And then time course. Okay, one episode, you get 1 point. A second episode, you get 2 points. The time to maximal pain has to be under 24 hours. It has to resolve within 14 days. This isn't a chronic problem. Acute gout is self-limiting. And you have to have complete resolution between the episodes if they've had more than one episode. And then you can get some points for elevated uric acid levels. And if their level is low, you have to subtract 4 points. If it's elevated, you can get 1, 2, or 3 points, depending upon how high it is. So to meet the 8 points that you need, if you don't have a positive crystal search, you pretty much have to have at least some of everything up here without the negatives. All right, so gout follows a pretty typical course, and number one would be asymptomatic hyperuricemia. We know that some of the patients who have this will be depositing monosodium urate crystals or gout crystals into cartilage during that time period. They have no symptoms, and it's not indicated to treat the patients at that point. And then something shifts the balance. You put them on Lasix because of their CHF. They get sick. They have a febrile illness. They have too much to drink at a New Year's party, and they get an acute flare-up. The joint is red, hot, painful. The most common is the first MTP joint. After the MTP joints, the ankle would be the next most common, then the knee, then wrists and fingers. It can affect pretty much any joint in the body, and then it goes away. That's important to remember. Acute gout is self-limited. It will get better. And then they go into an intercurrent period where there's no symptoms. And we know during that time period they're still building up crystals in the cartilage. And then go into another acute flare-up, and then another intercurrent period, and that cycle will repeat for a while. And then a portion of the patients will move into chronic gout, which is a slowly erosive, destructive disease. It can be as crippling as rheumatoid arthritis. I'll never forget the first patient that I saw of that way back when when I was a rheumatology fellow, a patient who was admitted to a rehab hospital with chronic refractory rheumatoid arthritis, wheelchair bound, and had a red hot swollen knee. And I, being a fellow at the time, got the job of sticking a needle in, getting some fluid out, injecting the joint for the attending. I went and looked at the fluid because I always looked at every fluid when I was a fellow. And sure enough, loaded with crystals. Turned out to be a case of polyarticular chronic gout that was mimicking rheumatoid arthritis. So it can be a very crippling, disabling disease if you let it go. So the foot over there is the classic kind of presentation of acute gout, a red, hot, painful MTP joint. The other picture is of an elbow with an enlarged olecranon bursa and a vial next to it showing what came out of it, which is thick white stuff that's all crystals. and a classic sign of gout. This is what the crystals look like under polarized microscopy with a number two red filter. They're yellow and blue, negatively birefringent needle-shaped crystals. That's a board question. It's on the last 2 years, so I'd remember that one. Negatively birefringent needle-shaped crystals. They're yellow and blue. They're monosodium urate. They're formed when either the serum is supersaturated with uric acid or when there's something that's triggering the formation of crystals in the body. Uric acid is a byproduct of purine metabolism, so anything that increases purine metabolism is going to increase that level. The saturation point is 6.7. Above that, you're supersaturated, have a high probability of clumping together into crystals. If you leave it alone, you start getting this. These are tophi. Those are clumps of crystals. If you stick a needle into one of those and take some stuff out and look at it, you're just going to see sheets of needles under the microscope. Something good to remember when you're in practice, the upper outer lobe of the ear is a common place for these crystals to get deposited, and it's an easy place to get the crystals out. So if you don't want to stick a needle in a red hot joint, if you find a lump on the outside of the ear, you can prick that with a needle, put a slide up against it, or take some material with the needle, put it on a slide, you'll see these crystals underneath. Okay, x-ray findings. So the classic x-ray finding for gout, the classic description, is a rat bite. That terminology showed up on the boards last year. So I'd remember rat bite. If you see that, I'd skip down and mark gout and keep going after that. They've never really looked like a rat bite to me. Let's see. I guess I can't point with this. So on the slide that's on your left, in the first MTP joint, there's a big hole on the outer side of it. It's supposed to look like teeth marks. And on the hand x-ray on the wrist, let's see, would be your left-hand side near the thenar, the first CMC joint, another area where there's a hole out of it. Those are typical x-ray findings for gout. Okay, so gout is caused by uric acid clumping together, forming crystals. That's hyperuricemia. Hyperuricemia is divided into both primary hyperuricemia, which is not caused by anything else, or secondary hyperuricemia caused by another disease. Most hyperuricemia, especially, most primary hyperuricemia is idiopathic. About 90% are under excreters, 10% overproduction. And that ratio, important to keep in mind. You don't have to know the exact numbers. Most of the patients with primary hyperuricemia are going to be under excreters, and that's important for treatment. Okay, for primary hyperuricemia overproduction, there's four enzyme problems that have been shown to be associated with this. Remember these four, they show up again later. One is HGPRT deficiency, PRPP synthetase superactivity, G6PD deficiency, fructose 1-phosphate aldolase deficiency. Okay, now under secondary hyperuricemia, if you skip to the end of the list, G6PD deficiency, fructose 1-phosphate aldolase deficiency, HGPRT deficiency. So they're associated both with primary hyperuricemia overproduction, secondary hyperuricemia overproduction. Other secondary causes are diet, real rich foods, anything with alcohol in it, lots of red meat, shellfish, all been associated with overproduction of uric acid. And then any of the myeloproliferative or lymphoproliferative diseases. So I would remember any types of cancer, anything that increases cell turnover rate, like psoriasis that I mentioned earlier, hemolytic diseases, severe muscle exertion, most of the endocrine diseases, and then this one was on the boards, the glycogen storage diseases. I've had this up for a number of years because I was told probably 7 years ago that it had shown up, and then it disappeared for a while. It was there again, so I'd remember this one. And you can remember them because they're the odd-numbered ones, 1, 3, 5, and 7. 7 was on the board. I don't know if it'll be on next year's. They don't use every question over again, but there is a high rate of questions being used again. For under excretion, all right, most are going to be idiopathic, and that's primary under excretion. For secondary, we have some very common problems: diabetic ketoacidosis, alcoholic ketosis, lactic acidosis, all cause hyperuricemia, all things that you're going to see regularly in the course of an internal medicine practice. And then my favorite disease, I'm still searching for one, maple syrup urine disease. Haven't had one walk into my office yet, but that also falls under that category. And then we have enhanced tubular reabsorption from dehydration, from diuretics, again, very common problems. And then unknown mechanism, hypertension, lead exposure, hyperparathyroidism, and a number of drugs. Low-dose aspirin was on the boards. Lead was on the boards. Okay, so both of those were there. Whether they'll use the same ones or not, again, I can't tell you, but I'd remember those. And then for combined overproduction and under-excretion, again, these two show up again, G6PD deficiency, fructose 1-phosphate aldolase deficiency. All right, indications for treatment. Probably not what you got taught in school and through your residencies. Number one, any established gout. So if they meet those diagnostic criteria, they have more than 8 points, or you see crystals in the joint, those patients get treated. Anybody with more than 2 attacks per year who you suspect has gout, who have typical features, that's now an indication for treatment. That's new 2 years ago. That was not recommended 3 years ago. Any acute gout, any tophi, any uric acid stones, uric acid nephropathy, interstitial nephritis, so any of the sequelae from elevated uric acid levels. And then down at the bottom, this is another one that was recently added. Chronic kidney disease stage 2 or worse with elevated uric acid is now an indication for treatment. Again, that's new. I don't know if it'll be on the boards. It wasn't there last year. This will be the first time that it's been a recommendation for 2 years at the time they're putting the boards out. So treatment goals, number one, stop the acute attacks. Number two, get rid of any tophi that are there. Number three, prevent joint damage, and then decrease uric acid level below 6, and that is now the standard. Again, above 6.7 is supersaturated, so 6.8 and above. You want to have a little bit of a buffer zone, so you want that uric acid level below 6. If they start with a normal uric acid level, you want to decrease it by 50%. Again, you can have gout with a normal uric acid level. In the case that they gave on the rheumatology boards, I don't know if this will translate to the general medicine boards, was a patient who had acute gout with a uric acid level of 4. All right, this is a question I get asked a lot. It did not show up on the board exams, but I wanted to give all of you the answer. I've been asked, do I check all of my patients before I put them on allopurinol? And the answer is no. But there is some recommendations for this now. This is genetic testing to look for patients who are going to have an adverse reaction to allopurinol. The test is to check for HLA-B 5801. And this problem is most common in the Korean, Han Chinese, and Thai population. I work in Eastern Kentucky. We have no Korean families and no Han Chinese. Actually, we have no Chinese families or Chinese ancestry families and no Thai ancestry families, so really not a good reason for me to check it. I'm expecting to move to Northern California. I'll probably be doing this test a lot. So it'll depend upon your area of the country, your population, who you deal with. All right, treatment. The treatment is divided into acute and chronic, and the treatment with allopurinol does not cross over onto the acute side. I see this done wrong all the time. I see patients who show up in the emergency room, they think they have acute gout, and they give them colchicine and allopurinol, or they give them allopurinol. I see people coming to me from primary care offices being given allopurinol because of acute gout. You do not do that. The rule is you don't increase it, decrease it, or start it in the face of an acute flare-up. So acute treatment, number one would be colchicine. The dosing of that for someone with normal renal function is 2 0.6 milligram pills now, and then 1 pill in an hour, and then stop. And then the next day you begin BID dosing. The old give them a pill every hour until they're 50% better or get diarrhea is gone. It's been gone for a number of years. That was on the boards. Another option is indomethacin, and you can actually use any of the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. This is the classic one that's used. The proper dosing for that for acute gout is 75 milligrams twice a day. It's underdosed frequently. So proper dosing would be the maximum dose for the drug, 75 twice a day. You can use any other non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. You can use steroids, either injected into a joint or systemic steroids to calm it down. You can give them pain medicine. Remember, this is a self-limited problem. You have a patient in the intensive care unit and you don't want to give them a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug and you don't want to give them colchicine. You can give them pain medicine to carry them through. You can give them ACTH, which will stimulate them to produce their own cortisol. And the new kid on the block, Anakinra or Kineret, it's a biologic therapy originally developed for rheumatoid arthritis in 1999, I believe. Now has an indication for treatment for acute gout. You give them a single dose of that and it will shut down the gout. It's being tested right now for chronic therapy, which is why you'll see it on my list on the other side as well. For chronic therapy, you use a xanthine oxidase inhibitor as your primary treatment. Number one would be allopurinol because it's cheaper. Number two, febuxostat, which is Euloric, because it's a little more expensive. The advantage of Euloric is less incidence of peripheral neuropathy, less incidence of renal problems. So if you have a patient who has peripheral neuropathy or renal disease, you may want to go with that drug first. When you use those, you have to prophylax your patients. So you start with colchicine or indomethacin. You get the acute attack resolved, and you keep them on that drug. You don't stop it. And then you add allopurinol or febuxostat, I'll get the word out eventually. If you start them on allopurinol, you continue the prophylactic therapy for a minimum of 3 months with Euloric or febuxostat for a minimum of 6 months before you try stopping the colchicine or indomethacin. Again, that's done wrong all the time. You keep them on the prophylactic therapy. When you manipulate somebody's uric acid level, you change the equilibrium. The uric acid in the joint and in the cartilage is in an equilibrium state. When you lower serum uric acid, the body will start mobilizing it and absorbing it back, and that's a setup for an acute flare-up of gout. So you want to prophylax patients. Now, the recommendation of 3 months for allopurinol, 6 months of febuxostat is for people who have an acute flare-up of gout, who haven't had the disease for a long time. If you see lots of tophi, heavy uric acid burden throughout the whole body, you may have to prophylax them a lot longer than that. After those two drugs, or if you can't use those, the next option would be probenecid. Probenecid increases urinary excretion of uric acid, so you only use this in the under-excreters. Remember back earlier, that was 90% of the patients. Before you use that, you get a 24-hour urinary uric acid excretion and make sure that they're under an under-excreter. You don't use this in anyone with renal disease. You don't use this in anyone with uric acid stones. You can keep people on long-term non-steroidals or long-term colchicine. Sulfapyrazone is still out there. I really don't recommend that. And another drug that's indicated, pegloticase. This is an IV therapy. Up to 10% of patients, the number has been dropping down. Originally, 10% was the number when it was approved. Now I think it's about 6%, will have an anaphylactic reaction. It's given as an IV therapy once a month. You have to be prepared to deal with an anaphylactic reaction if you're going to give this drug. It will profoundly drop the uric acid level. So the only patient, actually, that I've given this to started out with a serum uric acid of 18. They got their first dose. It dropped down to 0.1. And those are the typical responses you want to see. If you don't see a huge drop like that, they're at higher risk for anaphylaxis. You don't give it to them again. If they've taken it and they've skipped doses and their uric acid level has come back up, or while under therapy, if their uric acid level has risen, you have to stop the drug. So a little bit of a dangerous therapy. It's not really something I recommend routinely to be used. Gout's not a fatal illness unless their toe hurts so bad it makes them fall down a flight of stairs and they break their neck. This has a potentially fatal outcome, so I'd want to be really careful about using that drug. Okay, so next disease, calcium pyrophosphate disease. The common name is pseudogout, but it comes in a lot of different forms. This is a disease that is not systemic, unlike rheumatoid arthritis and a lot of what my colleague and I are going to talk about this morning. It occurs exclusively in and around joints. And it can be asymptomatic or cause disease. So you can see calcium pyrophosphate and calcium pyrophosphate crystals in patients who are normal, who have no symptoms. And you can also see it in a lot of different disease patterns. So in its acute form, it can look like gout. It can have a red, hot, swollen joint. It's why you want to stick a needle in the joint, get fluid out, and do a crystal search in patients who have these types of symptoms. They can have low-grade fevers, they can have an elevated white count, they can have an elevated SED rate, so they can look infected at the time that that's going on. Gout patients can as well. Again, the best test is stick a needle in a joint, get fluid out, look at it, get a definitive diagnosis. There's a chronic form of this that can also look like osteoarthritis. One time it was called erosive osteoarthritis because it can cause bone erosions as well. It looks very similar to osteoarthritis. It's mainly in the knees and hips, so weight-bearing joints, but we also see it in the wrist, the first carpometacarpal joint. And then there's a polyarticular form of this that can mimic rheumatoid arthritis, and oligoarticular, for rheumatologists, that means four or less joints. Usually in the elderly, and you can get something called pyrophosphate arthropathy that early can mimic osteoarthritis and later can look like a Charcot joint. It also is one of the causes of early osteoarthritis. So calcium pyrophosphate disease can look like gout, can look like osteoarthritis, can look like rheumatoid arthritis, can be one of the things that was originally described as erosive osteoarthritis, can look like a Charcot joint, so it can present in a lot of different ways. On X-ray, you can see chondrocalcinosis. About 5% of the rheumatoid arthritis patients will have this, about 10% of the ones who are rheumatoid factor positive, and they do not all have symptoms from it. So again, just seeing this on X-ray isn't enough. 1 out of 4 gout patients in some studies have had this. That has not been my experience, but that's the most recent published number that I've been able to find. Up to 50% of osteoarthritic patients, when you're looking at elderly, can have this. Again, not my experience, but that's the published numbers out there. And 1 out of 5 asymptomatic patients can have this change on X-ray. Again, not my experience with it either. Those numbers seem very high to me, but these are the published numbers. It is present in about 4% of the adult population. About 50% of patients over 90, and because of that number, I'm guessing that these statistics came from looking at elderly populations. Okay, this can be a hereditary autosomal dominant disease, but can also be sporadic, can be caused by trauma. It also can be caused by osteochondral dysplasia and by other inflammatory diseases and by almost every metabolic disorder. So all of the endocrine diseases can cause this. And a good rule of thumb, all of the endocrine diseases can cause all of the crystal diseases. Good thing to remember when you're taking boards. It's much easier to remember it that way. This is the X-ray finding. This is a knee joint. And if you look in between the two bones, there's a white line. That white line is chondrocalcinosis. That's the X-ray finding from calcium pyrophosphate disease. It can also cause what's called a crown dens, which looks like a little ring of calcium around the dens. You can get wraparound patella. It looks like one of Saturn's rings around the patella on X-ray. Again, one of the potential causes for erosive osteoarthritis. To diagnose this, crystals in a joint. And this is the old criteria for gout as well. Crystals in a joint, you have it. Probable, you see other types of crystals showing up in the joint or a positive calcium stain in the joint. Possible, you see the X-ray findings. To diagnose this, you really want crystals. These are what the crystals look like. These are positively birefringent parallelogram-shaped crystals. Remember the difference between that and gout. Get that question right, make me happy. So positively birefringent parallelogram-shaped crystals. They're also blue and yellow. The pathology, it's caused by the enzyme that I have down at the bottom that I won't try and pronounce, NTPPPHase. That's the known cause. Patients have normal serum phosphate, normal phosphate excretion. They can have elevated inorganic phosphate in synovial fluid, but that's rarely tested. So basically the lab is going to look normal on these patients. Treatment, colchicine, just like you would for acute gout, but you keep them on it long-term. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs long-term. You can use steroids for acute flare-ups. It'll control it long-term, but you then have to deal with the side effects from the steroids. And then joint injections, physical therapy, and surgery for patients who are getting disabilities or bad joint damage. And then in my last 30 seconds, we have other crystals in the joint. And I always put this up because you guys are DOs. I'm a DO. I want you to be smarter than everybody else. And everybody forgets about these crystals and doesn't look for them. I've had some of my medical students at big MD institutions tell their attendings about these and made me look really good as a teacher. but last year this showed up on boards. So now I'd remember them also for your board exam. There are a couple of other types of crystals. They all have calcium in it. These are the names. You diagnose them by staining for calcium. You can either do an alizarin red stain or a von Casa black stain. Diagnosing them specifically requires X-ray diffraction. The synovial fluid will not show the crystals when you just look at it. These aren't visible under light microscopy. So you have somebody that looks like acute gout, and you take fluid out, and you see some white cells, but you're not seeing any crystals, and you're thinking, well, maybe it's infected. You do an alizarin red stain or a von Casa black stain, and you'll get little black dots or little red dots all over the slide, and that's a positive test. These diseases can cause bursitis, arthritis, tendonitis. They can cause damage to the epiphysis and epiphyseal dysplasia, and can also look like inflammatory osteoarthritis. Okay, that's my contact information. Please feel free to email me anytime or call me if you have any questions.